Welcome back, folks. It's Mark Steiner right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We're about to play for you a panel that I moderated last week. The panel was called Racial Justice in Urban Education, celebrating 5 years of transformational practice in urban schools. We had a panel that really delved deeply into issues of race and racism in our city schools from a local perspective and a national perspective. It was organized by the Alliance for Community Teachers and Schools, or ACTS as it's called. It's a group of activists and teachers who believe that children in our city schools deserve serious, nurturing communities so kids can become really strong, culturally grounded, and grow as students, which they're not getting now in many of our schools. They have a focus on what's called educational resiliency and advocate for the emergence of community teachers and community schools. Here's that conversation. Before we get there, I want to let you know that the panel has been edited down slightly. And if you want to hear the entire panel, which is worth it, please visit steinershow.org. But here's the conversation we had at the ACT Summit. And the issue, obviously, that we're wrestling with here, racial justice in urban education, this discussion couldn't come at a more, I think, fortuitous moment for lots of reasons. A was the recent release of the Yale Child Study by Dr. Gilliam with elementary school students. And the kind of implicit bias that teachers have. We use the word implicit bias, and I was talking to Eddie Perkins about that earlier before we went on, and was saying how that's sometimes that and words like institutional racism get kind of cloudy in what they really mean and how we put our hands around it. But what you can't put your hands around is the fact that what motivates us are things that we don't even realize are pushing us to say and think and see what we see or not see what we see, that race and racism are in the marrow of the bone of the society, and we have no idea. It's like being, when you're an adult, you wrestle with what happened to us as children. We don't even know what we're doing at the time with that. And I think it's the same thing with racism in our society, that we don't even know it resides within us, that we are wrestling with it. No matter who we are, it affects us all differently, but it's there. So we're going to talk about how that affects our public education tonight. And let me just introduce the panel just a little bit. Sitting to my immediate right is Dr. Edward Fergus, who is the Assistant Professor of Educational Leadership and Policy at the Steinhardt School of Culture and Education and Human Development at New York University. But let me just say this about him, that his knowledge of disproportionality, of how race plays into our education system, of how it affects black and Latino boys and others, and he is bar none, he's one of the deepest thinkers we have in this realm. And also doesn't just think about it, he has ideas about what we do about it. So we're looking forward to hearing this contribution during the course of the conversation. Next to him, of course, is Taylor Branch, Pulitzer Prize-winning author. Now, Taylor is somebody I've known for a long time. He's American in the King years, if I have it right, 2,912-page trilogy. Am I right, Taylor? Something like that? That really was one of those books that don't come along very often, that changed the nature of our discourse in society, our understanding of our history, understanding of who we are, of delving into a history that transformed America. And Taylor himself is a Southern boy and wrestled with lots of things growing up about being a white man from the South and understands this history in ways that many of us don't, both personally and as an intellectual and as a writer and as a thinker. So I've always been a huge admirer of Taylor, huge. So I'm glad he's here with us on the panel. And Karen Weber. Karen Weber is the Director of Education and Youth Development at the Open Society Institute, but she has been a professional educator her whole life. She's been a principal. She ran the Office of Student Support for City Schools. She has a law degree. And she, you know, many people who theorize and are advocates in different organizations have never had experience inside the classroom or running a school, what it means to be a teacher and a leader of a school. Karen understands, Dr. Karen Weber understands that. She's so critical to all this. So without further ado, let's begin. We're going to begin by having kind of opening thoughts from our panelists, engage in the discussion after that, and then engage you in that discussion this evening. So we're going to start with Dr. Karen Weber. You're not, you know, it's a JD, not PhD. I always want to give you a PhD. I don't know why.
I'll take it.
An honorary Steiner PhD. How's that? That won't go very far. But so Karen, let me start with you, Karen, and just I know that you have done, I'm sorry, we're starting with Taylor Branch,
yes.
My mistake, to get a sense of history of how we got to where we are, the history of segregation in our schools, what education means inside the black world, what it has always meant, for a perspective on
where we've come from to figure out where we're going next. Taylor.
Oh, wow. Well, that's that's a lot. I'm the only one up here without a doctorate. I'm not an educator. I'm here to be educated. It looks to me like racial justice and urban education could just as easily be urban justice and racial education. So that we can start from the basics. I just want to set some racial context for the importance of education in American history at a very basic level before we get into the nitty-gritty of education. At the risk of discussing law in the presence of Judge Davis, I want to start by saying there's no fundamental positive right to education in the U.S. Constitution. There's no federal right to an education, just as there's no federal right to vote. The 15th Amendment bars discrimination in voting, but it doesn't affirm a right to vote, nor to get an education. That could be the beginning of a basic political agenda, and the reason it's basic, I believe, is because both of those issues, voting and education, impact racial politics. That's why that positive right is not in the Constitution, because it would get right at the grist of things that are basic in fundamental American life. Our society is driven much more by racial politics than we ever let on. We live almost in alternate realities. We're either discussing politics or we're discussing race. We discuss race when a crisis comes up and everybody says we need to discuss race. And often people say we need to have a definitive conversation, and you always know that we're in bad shape because you can tell that they want to have a definitive conversation to get it over with so that we can go back. And that's the first telltale sign that the conversation is stillborn from the very beginning. So that we have, race has always been integral to American politics, and yet our politics, even in a modern age where we have made enormous progress in some respects in race, is still that we either have politics or race. We're either talking about what Donald Trump is insulting or doing this, that, and the other, and it's a game within the bounds of turnout and that sort of thing, or we're talking about a racial crisis that makes people uncomfortable. Race has always driven our politics, whether we're liberals or conservatives, and in fact, the least examined area, in my view, in racial politics in American history is constraints among people who were formerly liberals, who are primarily addicted to some form of safe label of a moderate or in race relations as a substitute for personal interaction across the lines that divide us, which is really where the only grounding for comfort, for learning, and for civics is in racial education as in racial politics. And I believe that it is because so many of the people from the former civil rights era are uncomfortable about race still that most of us prefer to call ourselves progressives rather than any term that is associated with civil rights. We don't call ourselves liberals. We don't call ourselves freedom fighters. We don't call ourselves racial progressives. We call ourselves progressives, which is a term that goes back to Woodrow Wilson, who was anything but progressive racially. So our society really is divided on politics, and it is a joke on us that we only recognize it in times of crisis. Now, how can education help that? That fundamental divide. Education is still important. I can't tell you how many of the thousands of people I interviewed from the civil rights movement came from families that absolutely worshipped education, that they lived and died by it. Their grandparents did. They all said, you know, that the grandparents sacrifice for the parents, the parents sacrifice for the children, and it's one of the most astonishing facts that the sit-in generation was very predominantly a generation of the first people in their families ever to go to school, ever to go to college, and they risked all of it by going to jail in that period. Education was important to them and vital to their families, and many families ate their hearts out because their children were getting involved in things that could threaten the benefits of that education. And yet the sit-in generation thought enough of those values and learned enough about those values from their family and in the course of education to risk it all in the course of that civil rights revolution. So it's really remarkable how important it was, how important it remains. And the only, as an avenue of discovery, as an avenue of advancement within families. The last thing I want to say is a word of caution. Education is still important. But there's some doubt as that education is important, as important financially as we'd like to think. Stresses, is college education worth it? Why are law schools going down? There is technology affecting education? And to me, most fundamentally, what kind of education are we offering, particularly to our young students, and in the elementary and secondary grades? The point of concern for me is that we have sacrificed precisely the areas of education that deal with what's most important in race relations, which is the ability to relate to people across boundaries in areas of discovery and discomfort and develop a capacity for doing that. We now measure our schools by reading and math, so that the arts are out. Anything that helps a kid understand how to relate to other kids is devalued. Even, and most vitally to me, history, which is the only way you're going to learn what it means to be an American, the story of freedom, the story of civil rights. We learn it through history, but as I travel around the country, if you're a good high school history teacher, you're under pressure to teach English because history grades don't help your school. So the kind of education that educators are dealing with, you guys are all under pressure to emphasize the kind of education that may not produce citizens. And if we don't have good citizens who understand race relations and the meaning of in the context of American freedom, I don't think that it matters how much substantive knowledge we have, because only citizens understand how we relate to one another in the world. Thank you.
We turn now to Dr. Karen. Wait, to Karen Weber. I'm going to make you. You get your PhD before the night is out. To Karen Weber, who's done a lot of work around the issue of toxicity of racism in our schools, and I'll let you just go.
Thank you. First of all, I wanted to correct one thing. I'm actually a lawyer by training, and the first part of my life was all dedicated to civil rights. Part of the reason for that is that my parents were part of that sit-in generation, the first generation of African-Americans who went to college in the South in a African-American institution, came up north, fought for rights. So it was in my blood. It was natural. I actually came into education later in life, even though it was 13 years ago, and I came in as a civil rights advocate. I think that was very beneficial to me, because what I saw, the devastation that I saw in poor African-American communities, I was actually not prepared for. And I grew up in New York City. New York, at the time when I grew up, was very segregated. So all African-Americans, whether you were rich, poor, middle, whatever you were kind of in the same neighborhood. So I thought I knew what was happening until I got into that classroom. And some of the stories, just by asking open-ended questions and finding out personally some of the trauma that the students were experiencing made my hair fall out, probably literally. From there, I decided, how am I supposed to deliver content to students who are in these kind of dire straits? How do I reach them? How do I make what I have to say relevant? And so it was a transformation process for me. I think it was made easier by the fact that I was older than the TFA teachers. I'm calling them students. The TFA teachers who were 22 years old. They didn't have a bag of tricks to pull things out of. Some of them were almost as young as the students that they were teaching in high school. And I decided, well, this is the first job that I may lose, but I'm going to lose it going down doing the right thing. And that's what I did. I did what made sense to me. And one of the things I want to talk about in that trajectory, so the first year I was terrible, and so were most first-year teachers, but I was terrible because I was trying to do what I was being told to do. And then I learned about a practice called restorative practices. And I brought that with me into the classroom, and for the first time made clear to the students that I respected them and that I actually honored their voice. By so doing, I opened the doors of true education, because true education happens, just like Mr. Branch has said here, through relationships. That is nothing that is taught in the classroom for teachers or for principals. You're not taught about how to relate to your students, how to create a positive climate, either in the school or the classroom. So if you're not 40 years old, you really don't have a lot to go on. Having said that, we created a community in my classroom, and it was easy then to teach because I wanted to learn, too. I wanted to come to school, too, because this was my group. After that, of course, kids did well on tests because they opened their minds to study, and it was like, if you don't care about me, I don't care about you, and that included the curriculum because the curriculum didn't belong to them per se. I took this same mentality into a schoolhouse and became a principal, still definitely looking at education through a civil rights lens, and saw so many injustices. I saw how our children are treated in a school environment. In the classroom, you can close the door and not really know what's going on in the rest of the school. Not so when you're the principal of a school. And you're privy to so much that's happening, even more than you knew, that's happening in the students' lives. So one of the things that became important to me was for the teachers to somehow share in the lives of students. That became a priority for me. Because what happens is that it humanizes the experience. You're much less likely to throw a kid out on his ear or whatever part if you know what's happening in their lives, if you know why they're asleep on the desk in the back of the room, if you know why when you say certain things they get triggered and go from 0 to 100 in 5 minutes. And without that knowledge, you just feel overwhelmed and you feel like you really can't manage and that you've really chosen the wrong profession. So having said that, we began a restorative approach in a school called the National Academy Foundation. Paul Wollman was the president of our advisory board, who's a businessman, a philanthropist, and had so much to offer the children. The main thing about having this restorative approach was that everybody was given respect, that was the given, that people were going to be respected when they came in the door. We grew from a school of 300 students. In a two-year period, we went to 850. And that's called voting with your feet. People came because when they came, they were taken care of. As a mother myself, I worried when my children were in school. And I treated and wanted the children in the school that I was the principal of to be treated as my own. And that carried forward. What I'll say about my time in the district is that I got to see other schools. So in each progression, I saw more and more of the toxicity. And I had to delve deeper to see what was going on. Why are we treating our children the way we treat them? And some of it is because the children definitely often come in with chips on their shoulders. They do. 85% of our children are free and reduced meals, which mean they basically live in poverty. And they have the associated problems that go along with poverty. We educators are not given any training to handle any of the behaviors or the issues that come in. So you've set up sort of a conflict that seems unresolvable. But with, and I'm going to say the word again, with restorative practices, it's really such a simple process, but things are very easily resolved. The other thing I want to point to, and then I'll stop talking, is this idea of racial threat. In addition to there being some disconnects between classes, because we speak a lot about race, and we talk about the great divide just being a black and white issue or a minority-majority issue, but it's also a class issue. And so if 95% of the teachers in your school, regardless of their race, are middle-class people, and they're dealing with students who are in circumstances that they don't understand, you set up another kind of dynamic that is really irreversible unless you do specific and targeted training. This idea of racial threat, though, is one that I came across as I began to do trainings throughout the district on school climate. My basic premise with school climate was that school had to be a place where everybody wanted to come. It wasn't about us forcing people through the door, whether it was teachers, students, parents. It was about welcoming people in the door and then providing them with what they needed when they got there. And it's something that doesn't take money necessarily. It takes an attitude and it takes a shift in mindset. Back to the idea of racial threat. What we see across the country in the context of education, but also we see it in juvenile justice, criminal justice, even at major gatherings, when there are a large number or a majority of African Americans, automatically this knee-jerk reaction kicks in of control and punishment. And there's a perceived threat just by virtue of the fact that there are this many African Americans in a space. And it's so subconscious that people don't even realize that it's rearing its ugly head, but it's very pervasive and it's been documented by the research. So if we become aware of some of the things that we carry as Americans, like we've all been taught to control black people. Nobody would ever say that in a training, but that's what's true. We've all been taught to be threatened by African Americans or black people. And our reactions from that threat are what we see happening with children being pushed out who are children of color. 3 times the number of black children are pushed out through suspensions and other harsh punitive measures. So these are some of the conversations that I've been having with my colleagues, but also more importantly, having with educators and school leaders who can begin to change the mindset from one of a punitive nature to one that looks for restoration in the schoolhouse. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. Dr. Amy Fergus.
Thank you. You sit here mesmerized by the amazing sort of narrative that you all have laid out, and you know, and I know there was the email exchanges in terms of where we were going today, and we're going in different directions, and I love it. So with that in mind, I'm going to go along with the group, right? And actually talk about both Taylor and what you both brought to this conversation in terms of how we think about sort of the context of how race has sort of emerged in our dialogue. And for me, you know, as a, I was sitting at a table and somebody asked me, so what do you do? And, Technically my job is I am an assistant professor at NYU in educational leadership and policy, right? But I spend most of my time in schools. That's where I live and breathe, because that's always been the context in which I grew up in. I started 20 years ago as a history teacher. And I started teaching actually in Wisconsin in a predominantly white school. And I remember the first day of the keynote, where you actually have an opening keynote person who, kind of rallies the staff and gets them excited for the year. And I remember the keynoter was just talking about something and said, "Hey, you're like a fly in a cup of milk." And I know that individual had not imagined in any shape or form, what that meant for me to experience, right? I already knew I was on my own in that context, right? Particularly given that, the teachers kept saying the first couple of weeks, "Gosh, you're the first black teacher we've had in about 20 years, right?" And it was almost as if there was a pride to it, right? That's like, wow, we finally. But it was disconcerting, right? Because that, for me, it really meant what are the ways in which you've kind of practiced understanding what it meant to actually engage with people that were different from you, right? And so I knew that that first year they were going to try out a whole bunch of stuff on me, right? So I ended up having these really tumultuous sort of experiences. I actually started journaling all of it, right? And at the end of the year, I realized I had a decision to make in terms of going to graduate school or continuing to teach, and I said, "I'm going to graduate school," right? And part of it was really the toxicity, right? From my students, I remember one student saying to me one day, "Mr. Fergus, I'll beat you like Rodney King," right? So this was in 95, so this is several years after, right? So it's not, it was bothersome, right? I wasn't too proud of my reaction to that comment. I'll talk more about that later. Students saying, "Oh, Mr. Fergus, we saw you driving in with your ghetto mobile," and I'm like, "No, it's just a Chrysler, okay? That's all it is, But I thought what got me thinking about that particular narrative is really in connection to the work that I'm getting to do now. As Mark highlighted, for the last 12 years specifically, I've had an opportunity to really work on this very specific set of issues around disproportionality in special ed, suspension, and gifted programs. And I see them as the sort of the trifecta of outcomes that are all tied to the same symptoms. Tied to the same issues, right? And that is the way in which race and racism sort of manifests itself. And over these last 12 years, I have worked with 65 school districts on this particular issue. Some of it through the confines of, contracts that I have with school districts. Some of it has also been through work with the Department of Justice when they go in and sue some of these school districts. And, it took me a while as I started off, my day job is as a faculty member, right? So, and I've written a lot of different stuff. I've written 3 books, and finally I got a chance to write the book that I wanted to, which is actually coming out in 3 weeks, on disproportionality. And it's actually for practitioners. And what I ended up sort of really focusing on is really thinking long and hard about that experience my first year teaching. And I thought about sort of what does it mean to, what's that toxicity of sort of how racism kind of manifests itself. And I, as a history person, I really started thinking about the 1954 Brown versus Board, and this is about 4 years ago. I was at one of the many celebrations of Brown where we were sort of reflecting on, and somebody said, "We've been doing this integration work, right?" And I made a comment, something to the effect of, "Well, we've done 2 integration projects. The first one has been integrating kids, right, where we try to integrate kids of color with white kids, right? But we've also had another integration project, which is integrating white practitioners who had not been legally and socially had an opportunity to work with children of color since 1954. And that's been another integration project that we've been doing. And that actually kind of sparked my thinking around sort of, you know, and really reflecting on my own narrative as a practitioner and thinking, so what is that necessarily, what is that, how is that meant for that experience for a practitioner? And the work that I've been able to do with these 65 school districts around policy and practice reform, which has included restorative justice and PBIS and redoing codes of conduct, and as much as I can applaud all the work that's been done, I can't help but wonder, does that necessarily mean that these practitioners have been prepped enough to be able to do this second integration project, right? And in particular, you know, as I think, you know, in thinking more about it, you know, and as because I'm a researcher, I said, I need to study this. So I partnered up with, you know, Russell Skiba, who's out of Indiana University, who's also doing work around disproportionality. And he had been developing this climate scale into really trying to measure sort of beliefs within, you know, and I, you know, so we had a long conversation and I said, you know, I'd love to use that scale along with another survey stuff that I've been doing in my school districts, right? So several years go by and, you know, and so what I ended up sort of learning in really measuring sort of climate, right, particularly the climate of beliefs, right, this, and these beliefs are really around sort of the notion of integration. There were three beliefs that really resonated for me in the data from the practitioners who participated in these climate surveys. And the three beliefs, which I consider are, you know, closely connected to the ways in which we imagine integration, is colorblindness, deficit thinking, and the third one, which I've, you know, is, I'm calling it poverty disciplining, which is the idea that of, whenever I say it, people are like, what do you mean by that? Well, it's the idea that we are trying to, within our practice of education, discipline the poverty out of low-income kids. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We're asking parents to sign contracts for certain behaviors. Mm-hmm. We're asking kids to wear certain uniforms. We are mandating that they pull up their pants, right? We're trying to do as much as we can to control their behaviors, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. A great example that I always think of is a school that I was doing research around about 6 years ago, and actually it's one of the schools that's featured in my book, the Schooling for Resilience book, where the kids start off the school year on the floor. They have to earn. Mm-hmm. They have to earn their teachers. They have to earn their desk through their displayed behaviors, right? And outside of the school was a banner that said, you know, nothing in life is free, right? So it's these examples of sort of the types of beliefs that is symbolic of the type of integration work that's actually happening, right? The ways in which our adults are creating climates for our kids of color, right? They themselves are figuring out, they're also doing that child development work. They're doing their social, emotional, cognitive, moral, and physical work, and simultaneously also gaining levels or being exposed to levels of toxicity, right? That as I see, particularly when I hear from schools that, you know, and particularly school districts that are working on disproportionality and suspension, they always say, well, Eddie, you don't understand these kids. Yep. I mean, they're just bad, right? And I said, well, they could just be reacting to the level of toxicity, and which in some ways could be a normal response, right? It is the, if you constantly are experiencing continuous experiences of threat, right? Mm-hmm. You know, there's a moment in which you're going to push back, right? And the last thing I'll say around this is, you know, I'll use an example of sort of what happens when pushback happens. I was working with one particular school that had issued suspension, and I had that principal, you know, had a hard time, you know, needing to work on that belief part as well as the practice piece, that became one of the principals. I always have cadres of principals, right? The principals who don't want to do the belief work, so I just say, well, guess what? You're going to have to institute these practices. Mm-hmm. You have no choice, right? So we're just going to drag you along. And, you know, this particular principal really had a hard time kind of wrapping his brain around it, and until there was an incident in which a black male student ended up pushing a white female teacher. Well, the response was to suspend the student until they saw the video of the hallway interaction, in which the teacher kept pointing her finger and the student kept moving back until the student was up against the wall, and then the student pushed. Which I always think of that as sort of very symbolic of this, when kids are just at a moment where they're exposed to so much levels of threat and toxicity that they push back. And we have to recognize we have to be able to ask the question of what happened to you, not the question of what's wrong with you. Yes. Right? And that's where I'll start in terms of this race and racism dialogue.
So
thinking about what the three of you just said, we're sitting in Baltimore, where in the city, where the majority of children in schools and public schools are black and poor working class kids, the vast majority of our kids. And that toxicity is around them, as you describe, all day long, from the moment they get up to they get to school and go back again. Not every minute. This is not like a kind of a white liberal version of how tough it is to be black. It is because there's equal amounts of beauty inside of people's homes and lives too, right? But what they have to go through to get to a place breeds that toxicity. So the questions I really would like to really explore. So what? I thought about a couple things. I was thinking about the history in the 19th century, and I was thinking about the post-enslavement and the push to education that happened among so many people to really want to learn and fill schools up from the ages of 8 to 80, and what that meant. That came out of the Freedmen's Bureaus. That came out of the people who came in, the abolitionists and others, to do the teaching. And the hope that was part of that, like just the hope that drove students into the civil rights movement, was that same hope that drove students, right? So now we have a situation where two things. A, we've got kids who have spent, whose families over the last 50 years, 60 years have been part of the most left out part of the population of America. They've been left behind in the inner cities. And you've also got racism that, as we talked about earlier, that people don't even know it exists. I mean, the Gilliam study just showed from Yale. So how do we wrestle with that? Both historically, what did we learn from that? But what do we begin to do to change that? It can't just be about public policy. It's got to be something much deeper than public policy. Not that public policy is not important, but it has to be something a lot deeper than public policy. We're going to get to the heart of this and deal with our kids. So where do we start that? How do we start that? Karen, go ahead.
I certainly don't have the full answer, but one of the things I'll say, though, is that I still have a lot of hope for education. I think that one of the problems in education, and this is really going to maybe sound like an insult, but is that there are only educators in the school. So they've been taught to deliver content. That's what they've been taught. And so I sit in meetings where there are lawyer advocates and educators, and the advocates are speaking one language and the educators are speaking a totally different language. Until we have some more cross-pollination, like the problem is with the adults. It's not really with the children. And the problem is what we're focused on. You cannot deliver content until you have an environment that is humane. And we've gone so far away from that. It's the factory approach. You spoke of children having to sit on the floor and earn their way up to a desk. I've seen children who, if they misspeak or they speak to a friend, which everyone is bound to do in a six-hour day when you're not allowed to speak, they have to stand on a line until the teacher tells them that it's okay to come in. And these are high school kids standing still on a line. That's corporal punishment. all kinds of behaviors are exacted toward our children because we don't understand them. And the other piece of this is that when we do begin to understand them, we don't know what to do with it. So until we have, and back to the educator comment, I'm not slighting educators because it is the hardest job on the planet. But until we have some underpinning so that educators are able to do something with the information that they receive, we're not going to have a system that makes any sense.
I'd only say quickly on history that the historical approach to all of this, to me, begins with recognizing that history often seduces all of us with labels that uneducate us about the role of race in American education and in American politics. You mentioned all the schools that were formed in the wake of the Civil War. There are two words today that describe, that everybody knows, even if they don't know anything about their history, that describes the people who believed in those schools: scalawags and carpetbaggers. Those are both negative terms about the people who started those schools, many of which were burned down, and the rights that they were working for were overthrown. And our history books still label the period that overthrew all of that education and that voting, redemption. It's a religious word. You know, to think that that's still in our history books, and the way that I would take it now is the black-led civil rights movement in the 1950s and 60s set in motion liberation, not just for black people, but for anybody who's got a daughter, for anybody who has a gay person in their family, a disabled person, anything. It was all the example. When America deals with race, good things happen for everybody, but that is not part of the way it's taught. It's controversial, even among black activists, because they say to emphasize the benefits that our movement led to other people will denigrate our remaining agenda. We don't want to talk about what we did for other people. But we do have a warped history. It's absolutely crazy that we let loose the greatest liberation in the history of the world 50 years ago, and we live in a cynical age that pretends that nothing good can happen. And it's because, in my view, we are so reluctant to acknowledge the fact that it was black leadership. We don't know anything. We don't know where it came from. And we can't acknowledge it. So we have a warped view of history. And that's got to fit into these classrooms where these teachers and students are struggling to relate to each other.
You know, your question on sort of what do we do? You know, you can't legislate your way out of it or into it. Right. It reminds me of, I remember reading Transgressing Education by Bell Hooks, where it was a statement that she wrote in there that it's always stuck with me for years, which is that, you know, can you legislate people to get along? And so this question around, said, you know, how do we deal with sort of this texture of, you know, of racism, this history of it? You know, do we sort of build it into sort of the policy frameworks and practice frameworks that we have going on, right? So we have restorative justice as, you know, the newest item on the menu that everybody's super excited by, and, you know, PBIS and RTI, all these sort of, you know, common core, and we're still asking ourselves a question of, you know, so within each one of these frameworks that we're practicing, we're still finding ourselves still having disparate outcomes. Right, so we have to ask ourselves a much more fundamental question around all of these. And in no shape or form am I challenging that we shouldn't do any of those practices, but rather, you know, they have to be predicated on a different moral foundation of addressing or undoing racism, the institution of it in our work. And I know Mark and I were talking right before, and you know, is the, and Mark actually used the term, you know, do we need to think about it as sort of, you know, folks having therapy, right? The need for it, you know, and I know it's not something that we can imagine as a, you know, it's like, we can't do that. Well, the therapy has to exist in different disciplines and institutions, right? They need to exist as part of our K-12 work. And I think about it in terms of the, you know, how teachers are trained, right? That conversations around diversity are not an extra course that they have to take as part of their certification, but rather a fundamental moral foundation of just as much as we talk about the importance of how John Dewey sort of play a role in, you know, the span of education, right? But that's our hard work that we're uncomfortable to decide to actually sort of endeavor into that work, right? So, and we see it classically being played out in sort of the current election, in which you have candidates who are on a spectrum, I will say on a spectrum, of how they kind of vacillate in thinking about race and racism, right? So you say race, they say law and order as a knee-jerk reaction, right? Another one says, you know, you say race to another one, and, you know, they start, you know, start telling sort of individualized narratives, but can't get to the core of, so what becomes our moral imperative of actually addressing racism? Because, you know, I keep, you know, one of the things I want to make sure that we're, you know, and this is part of what I'm hearing from Taylor, is the race isn't the problem, it's racism, right? So, because, you know, we're all sort of racialized beings that, you know, that in itself isn't the problem, but rather the way in which we've manifested it into sort of set of actions. So I think our work, you know, how do we do this, is it's something that, and so obviously we have not clearly imagined, but I think there have been significant pushes in areas of research that have been landing in practice. You know, I know Dr. Gloria Latson-Billing's work around culturally responsive pedagogy has been amazing to actually, you know, I sit in New York City where finally I'm sitting in meetings where the central office is saying, you know, I think we need to make culture responsive core to how we talk about our code of conduct. I was like, hallelujah, right? Before it was just like, oh, it was an extra training that mm-hmm. we're offering. Mm-hmm. Now it's a foundational lens that we're using, right? And maybe that needs to be sort of part of our remedy strategy, is that we have to change the framework that we're starting to use in our own work versus just adding in another item to the menu of solutions.
Can I speak to that? I just wanted to speak first about policy, because there's some folks in the room that helped create the most amazing school discipline policy for Baltimore City. And the problem is that no one's been trained on it. So there it is on the shelf. People are copying it all over the nation. Calls are coming in. But the training has stopped. So who understands how to unpack it? One of the things, though, I do, and I know I'm going to beat this horse to death, but I do want to say about restorative practices is that it's not a newfangled thing. The Maori in New Zealand use it to resolve conflict. The Wolof in Senegal, West Africa, use it to resolve conflicts to this day. It's a human experience. And I think the problem has been that we're so afraid to have human experiences in school that we're now completely devoid of them. And that doesn't work for children. It actually doesn't work for adults. If you look at the staggering number of teachers who are absent on a daily basis in some of the schools that are having the hardest time, they're being battered to death. So if we don't bring humanity back, it's not coming back through PBIS. It's not coming back through Common Core. It won't come back until we start having conversations. And all this does is give us a framework to sit down and allow children to have a voice. You can literally be a child and go into a school at 8 in the morning and never be asked your opinion till you leave in June at the end of the day, not even once. So when you speak of discipline and what a child is asked, they're not asked anything. Somebody looks in the book and sees what they can give you. I can give you 3 days for this. Take your note and take it home. No one asks you anything. So student voice, the voice of humanity, if that's not brought back into our schools, we'll never succeed.
Is this working? Yeah, it is working good. So we're going to jump out here to the audience. If you have something you want to say, I want you to just come closer to me so we don't have to stretch this too far, and I'll hold the mic just to make sure we get the sound right. But you know, as we come on up, sir. So if I'm curious, if there's any place where things were actually happening, and how are they happening? How do we begin to understand the history we cannot do without if we understand to understand where we are today. Where are there places where, I keep going with the studies, I just read the study this morning, Gilliam study from Yale. So you have the teachers who were shocked and saw what they did when they looked at the behavior of a black child and white child. It was actually the same behavior, but they thought the black child needed discipline where the white child did not. Then they weren't even aware that they were doing it. So what's the step then? Okay, so there's an awareness. So what comes next? Where does it go? I mean, what are the examples of how that begins to change, and what discussions have to happen to make that happen? You know, and we also, I think as Taylor was saying, if we don't understand where we come from, then we're going to keep repeating the mistakes over and over again. So who wants to grab it first? Whoever would like to.
You know, the only Eddie? Thing I'll say in terms of this, and touching on sort of something that Taylor mentioned, is the idea that we would be remiss if we didn't recognize that the types of beliefs that individuals utilize to subconsciously sort of operationalize that belief into a practice, if we want to contend with that, we have to give them a replacement belief structure, right? It's, you know, and they're, so this part of humanity, you're right, and sort of that human experience, and part of that human experience includes the beauty of sort of cultural diversity that exists among us, right? But what would it look like for us to actually be the replacement belief that sort of it exists in individuals? Because the rationale behind why individuals sort of maintain a colorblindness perspective or deficit thinking is that it's helping them make sense of the world. It allows for individuals to kind of traverse and interact with people, right? So, you know, I hear often from practitioners, but I was taught, you know, and I live by colorblindness, right? So that's important to me. And particularly for some individuals, it's treated as if it's a more culturally evolved way in which to operate in the world, right? And so if we're going to do something, we really have to pay particular attention to this sort of this humanity experience.
I just wanted to say quickly, in as much as students don't have opportunities to speak during the school day, other than delivering content, teachers
right.
don't either.
Right.
So for teachers to see something that provocative, one would think then they would be able to have a conversation. But that's not what's normally happening. I'm thinking of a school right here in Baltimore, though, Commodore John Rogers, another school where you only went there if you had nowhere else to go. Now it's bursting at the seams. One of his practices, the principal's practices, is to have the teachers meet every single day, and they talk about content, they talk about the students, they're used to having conversations. I could imagine in a school like that they could tackle a conversation like this. But Mark, if I've never spoken to you, this is the last thing I want to start our conversation on, is what happened in this film. Well, I might want to, but the average person wouldn't be comfortable doing that. So there's this the climate development, it extends to the adults and the students. And until we have that kind of rapport, we're not going to be able to have these tough conversations.
And Taylor, as we go to the audience here, I was thinking what you were saying earlier, and I guess I must be in some kind of therapy modality at the moment. But I've started thinking about it. History as therapy. To kind of know why we're here, what we did, how we got here, what built on this place we're in, you know. I just thought about that. I mean, I think in some ways your books have been like therapeutic for the country. But what do you think about that?
Well, I would never say my books are therapeutic. They're therapeutic for me. On the notion of therapy, when I teach courses about the history of the freedom movement, I always ask students to do something that I learned from people in the movement, which is, aside from the content of what happened, to try to do something. Everybody in the movement told me that there was a two-step process, that you do something that is a challenge to you. It's a step into the unknown. And that's number one, and that's not... But number two is that you come back and you talk to your peers about what it felt like to do that, mm-hmm. and that's what creates the bond. Mm-hmm. And people like Diane Nash would say that every day in the movement was like her wedding day, looking back on it, because her knees were shaking. She knew she was taking a step that might define her one way or another, and that it was important. But she was taking a leap in the unknown, and that it was important to do that, but she was sharing it with other people. And that bond is what made the movement grow. Now, I don't know whether that could be analogous to what goes on in a classroom about the way kids relate to one another, and or even that teachers can relate to kids. But it's got to be more of a social process than it sounds like what I'm hearing these classrooms are like, where there's no time for anybody to have a conversation with anybody, and that it's just content delivered.
Sir,
so say who you are.
Hi, my name is Calvin Watkins. You go hold the mic, right? All right, you hold it. My name is Calvin Watkins. Okay, move. Okay. My name is Calvin Watkins. I want to thank you guys for being here. I'm not an educator. I'm an entrepreneur. I'm looking to open a charter school. And talking to Dr. Fergus and Dr. Weber, sort of two questions. I'm really new to this experience with education. And Dr. Weber, you said something that I picked up as soon as I had the idea, the notion, the passion to start a charter school, is get the kids involved. One of the things we're doing is innovation, teaching kids to be innovators, teaching them to be entrepreneurs. And we have to get the input. So we give them a problem. We say, you know what, this building can only hold 500, this room can only hold 500 people. How can this improve if it had more people? And talk to them and get their input. So I think it was really key. I'm new to the process. I'm wondering, why don't our teachers so stressed, not in the tent, but are they so structured because of all that's involved? I mean, they got salaries, they have to feed their families, they have to make sure they do the right thing so that they keep their job. How, because we're looking to have teachers that come in that are innovators. They have to be able to think different. And one of the challenges is making sure that they don't get in trouble outside of all the rules and regulations that are going. So if you could speak on that in terms of getting kids involved and being innovators. And real quick, Dr. Fergus, your third point on poverty something.
Poverty disciplining.
Disciplining, right. I'd like to hear a little more about that, because I think there is a framework. We do have to guide kids in a certain way. I'm totally against pants sagging. There's a rule you can't sag your pants. I don't want to see your underwear. But that's also understand that is some type of mindset, and you were getting to allude to that. So I'd like to find out more about that. I'm not sure if I can get your book about that, but if you can talk about that. And thank you.
Karen, you want to start?
I've already forgotten the first question.
How do we get the current system to get more involved with having kids get feedback? Because they have to have input. They need to talk.
Retired teachers are afraid for their jobs.
And I think you were speaking about teacher stress and that type of thing. I think you did. You said
I want to just guess, how do you get teachers and systems to understand that children, you said, children need to be more involved in the education process? You're able to just talk.
So I think one of the biggest barriers, that's the pink elephant in the room, is that no one really knows how to cope with behaviors that are extraordinary. And until we do unpack behaviors, understand them, and provide the right resources, we can't bring in the innovation that you're speaking of. And so, I'm not finished. And this is from experience. I was a principal of a school that had academies. Well, the academies could not do their thing if I was walking through the hallway as the principal and being told to go myself, which I was. You can't move forward until you get to the root of that. And the problem that happens in a school system is that all of us are supposed to be marching in time. There are certain things that are supposed to be happening on a daily basis. There are even people who come around with a clipboard and monitor where you are in your lesson. So you really have to be ready to lose your job in order to do the right job, which is to take the time and to set the school in such a way that it's a place where human beings want to be. So it's a time thing. And if you haven't been an educator, it's really hard to imagine.
So, Eddie?
I want to highlight something that you said at the onset in terms of how you're thinking about framing your charter school is this idea of problem solving as being the core framework of the work versus how much content kids are getting, right? So imagining schools being a space in which kids are coming in to learn how to solve problems, that's being at the core of sort of the curriculum, is something that, you know, is completely lost because of the manner in which we have moved in our standards era over the last 30 years that has become the architect of what our kids are getting. Absolutely. Now, and I say when our kids, I mean, it only is occurring in certain urban types of school settings, right? You know, it wasn't until I moved my kids to private independent schools where I was, I am amazed what my 12 and 16-year-olds are getting exposed to, right? Mm-hmm. They're in an independent school where they get to travel to a country, at least two countries every year, right? And it's woven into as part of the curriculum, right? They get to do, you know, a couple of weeks ago it was Peace Day. They had a whole several days just on peace, right? And that was part of the curriculum. But to your point around sort of poverty disciplining, it actually emerged out of, it was about 5-6 years ago, I was reading a book by Joel Soss, S-O-S-S, and he was cataloging the history of child welfare. And so he talked about sort of this, you know, that the way in which we've been addressing not child welfare, social welfare programs was to try to discipline individuals who are low income. In order for them to get cash assistance, we need to discipline them in particular ways so they do not maintain those psychological dispositions and those behaviors that we perceive as keeping them in the condition that we call it, right? And it really got me thinking about sort of the types of the ways in which that poverty disciplining belief shows up in schools and the ways in which we do manifest it and how we perceive what that sagging pants is about, right? So, because if we were to interpret it as youth culture behavior, we would need to take also ownership of the way in which we had youth culture behavior that our adults that were in charge of us did not like, right? Your own sagging pants. Right, but it may not have been a representation of you not being focused on education, right. You not caring about schooling, right? It was just part of youth culture. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that I am a supporter of sagging pants. With a 16-year-old boy, I keep reminding him about how the world sees him.
Right.
So that's another dynamic that I have to contend with, simultaneously also honoring the fact that this may be part of youth culture behavior.
So it's 8:07. We've been almost an hour, not quite. So y'all three are the three questioners here, and then let's wrap it up, all right? And so as I go up here, you said something that sparked something in what you said. So if all the studies show that black children are disciplined in greater numbers than other children, than white children, in our school systems, and some black teachers sometimes are driven to discipline black students because they think they need to be disciplined in order to be here and deal with this world. White teachers will discipline black students because they think just by what they're doing something wrong, and you got to be disciplined. So how do you change that? Okay, can you hear this? All right, I'll do it one more time. I'll make it quick because I'm going to get over here to the folks. I said discipline, poverty discipline we're talking about. Because of race and racism in America, a lot of black teachers harshly discipline students because they think they need to be disciplined in order to survive in this world. White teachers harshly discipline black students because they think that everything they do, move, and say is something wrong, and they have to be stopped and have to be changed, and the behavior has to change. So how do you change that behavior, not the students? How do we change our attitudes about how we approach those kids?
Do you want to...
You know, so and I'm going to bring it back to sort of the sense of a sense of humanity that practitioners have when they are how they are looking at behavior on different colored bodies. Okay, yeah. You know, for example, I had a school where two quick examples actually. One where a principal said, "You know, something. I'm really going to change the texture of what my practitioners are doing. So I'm going to ask all of my teachers to stand in the hallway in between class time to greet kids, right?" So lo and behold, what ended up happening is teachers were reprimanding kids. They were standing in the hallway, as they were told, and they were greeting kids, but they were also calling kids out and say, "Stop running. What are you doing?" So referral numbers actually went up, right? Because we hadn't dealt with a core fundamental framework of what it meant for you to actually have a humanistic perspective to how you're going to greet kids and observe behaviors. Right. You know, and the second example is, you know, a school where, you know, it was a high school that they were struggling with they were finding the kids' language disrespectful, so they put a policy in place that kids had to refer to teachers as Mr. and Miss. Well, they found that they were a lot of the Latino kids were getting flagged for behave for the not doing the Mr. and Miss because they were saying maestro, maestra, right? And it was fascinating when I came back and sat with them with that data, and I said, look, you had an idea of what you expected them to do, right? And they're representing it in a different way. Their response was, well, they need to speak English. They need to behave in our particular ways. So we have to do some very fundamental work around how this sense of humanity that our practitioners are needing to embody and help them know how to practice it often, because it is part of their worldview, right? I shouldn't say they. It is our worldview, because we also held some of those sense of or need to have some of that sense of humanity.
Do you want to add to that, Karen?
Okay, I'm going to let folks ask some questions.
I think my question actually follows this line of thinking. My name's Amy Edelstein, and I founded a program called the Inner Strength Foundation, which teaches mindfulness and cultural development. I have about 2,000 students in the program in the public schools in Philadelphia. I'm a product of the East meets West revolution. And so I'm newly back, really, after 30-some years in the American education system. I have been in America, but in that alternate reality, which is sort of a fringe, but very good training for this. My question is, do we have enough adults who can create the kind of space for teachers and administrators to really wrestle with these issues? I walked into school today to teach the students. The principal was shouting at his office people. He gave me a hug in the hallway. He said, I really need your mindfulness. Can you deal with our detention students? Because I deal with the honors students, with the International Baccalaureate students to support them. Can you work with our, you know, staff, teachers? You know, he was just desperate. And he said, come up with a program and let me know. And I really thought about it because I work with a coalition of teachers, and some of my African-American male teachers in the public education system say there's so much racial stress, there's no way to even begin to speak about this. Mm-hmm. So I guess what I want to know is, do you see enough adults who can facilitate the kind of spaces to work with these challenging issues?
Karen?
I'd like to speak to that. We have some amazing practitioners here in Baltimore. I'm going to be very Baltimore-oriented here. People may have seen trending recently, the Holistic Life Foundation, an amazing group of young men who are in our schools doing mindfulness practices. And that is a form of restorative practice, too. I mean, we shouldn't limit the thought about what's restorative to just sitting in a circle when something terrible has happened. It's a practice of actually being present and having community on a regular basis so that it feels normal. The problem that I've seen, at least in this district, and I've heard from people in other districts, is that they are fighting and wrestling with central office to get time and space. Everything is about instruction. And so anytime you're asking for principals or teachers to come together, it has to be about content. We're missing the boat. There's so many teachers among us who could be the trainers, who would be the trainers, and principals as well. The other thing that I find, I just don't even understand it, is the fact that we have exemplary models in every single district of principals who have fought the odds, who have 99% African-American students who are poor, 99% poor, and they still have schools where everybody wants to come. So why are we not emulating those practices? The practices are studied. They even exist on paper, but they're not being emulated because we are so entrenched. We so believe in the 1950s model of schooling that is not working for our children. And so we can't move forward. The skills are there.
Ma'am?
Hi. So I'm a product of the Baltimore City Public School System as a little tyke, and school was a refuge for me. A couple of things. The principal was out front every morning to greet us. The teachers clapped us in. They were so excited to see us every day. This was in the 70s. I was walking down from McCullough Street to get to Mount Royal. Principal France, when you learn your fractions, you came to recite them to her, and you got a special button that I recited my fractions for my principal. There was this spirit of civility, but also of great expectation. She would tell us that our circumstances were not a limit, but thank you for sharing. She also spent time with us not in an educational setting. So you saw the principals and the teachers at pickup games at the area basketball courts where they could just get to know us in a situation where all they had to do was enjoy us. And we would say, what are you doing here? And she would say, I came to have fun with you guys for a chance. That humanized all of us to her, and it gave her a peek into who we were, and it helped her meet, and that's my question, it helped her meet our parents. I had teenage parents. I was in poverty. She didn't care. They were welcome. They were on field trips because she made that connection. And I feel like the environment is also really adversarial for parents. There's this, the parents feel like they have to get to a certain point, a certain level of preparedness before they can even walk into the school. They're often not welcome in the environment, or that they can't get anybody to give them any answers. I had a principal tell me she basically discontinued an honor roll because she didn't want to talk to the parents about why a particular kid didn't make it. So there's this caving to not have to interact with minority parents at every level, at the GT level. And I feel like even in situations where kids do have high poverty and they are such a vital piece, how can we bring parents in as well to improve the climate? Not so that they feel like we just have a bunch of stuff we want to hand to them because they so need us, but because they're VIPs in their children's lives and we desperately need them to partner with us to ensure that their kids get everything they possibly can from the environment.
Great. Good. Who'd like to go first?
Thank you for sharing that, you know, telling your story. And you reminded me of, in terms of answering your question, so how do we do it or what do we need to do? There's an element to which, you know, as a parent, you know, and for a time period, I was a school board member in my school district, you know, which really changed the dynamic because it became, anytime I asked a question in terms of why is my child doing this, it became the, are you asking as a parent or as a board member? Which was really fascinating. But there's something that always stuck in my head when I read Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot's book on Essential Conversations, where she was talking about parents, and she talked about this idea of ghosts from the classroom, that parents are also going into school with their ghosts from their classroom experiences, right? And what I find fascinating is that as practitioners, when we are embracing and experiencing parents, we have to recognize that they're also coming in with those ghosts. Good, bad, and indifferent. And so there's a manner in which we have to sort of operate that it is a matter of being, there's a level of sort of maintaining humanity and being, and healing some of that, right? So as an individual who's in the field, but also has had a, you know, a roller coaster experience within education, you know, I'm coming in, you know, with a manner of asking certain questions, right, that practitioners, you know, struggle with knowing how they can kind of engage that, you know, and more often than not, unfortunately, sort of practitioners fall back on the, look, I just need you to show up for parent-teacher night, I need you to sign off on the homework, and if I call you, please just call me back, right? And we know that parents have a lot more to offer than just those dimensions.
I just have three things that we did at my school. Two that we did at my school. One is that we had an open door policy because we realized that parents were not always going to want to come at 6 o'clock at night. Sometimes they were at work. So as long as the doors were open at the school, the parent could come to the main office, get a little pass, and do what they needed to do. Sometimes they needed to deliver lunch money. They needed to have access so that they would feel comfortable, not for special occasions, but all the time. The other thing is that we had an event called Restaurant Night. Paul will remember this, where the students did the cooking and they put on this big, you know, gala affair, and it was all student-run. We had a student-run bank. When the parents realized that the students had agency in the school, it gave the parents agency as well. The third thing I'll say is that while I was in the district office, we created a process called the School Climate Walk. And the school climate walk was to work on the people who were in the school, the adults in the school. If I'm not greeted when I come in, if I ring the bell and I'm allowed to go anywhere I want in the school, first of all, it's not safe. Second of all, I'm clearly not being welcome. And then when I finally do meander into the main office when I find it, and I wait there for 10 minutes, and I'm at this time, I was dressed in office clothes. I wait for 10 minutes, somebody finally looks up at me and says, "What you want?" Like, really? So if I'm experiencing that, what are the parents experiencing? So we began, you know, this doesn't sound nice. It wasn't nice, but we began to nail people. Like, this is what we found in the climate walk. This is what was happening in your school. What are we going to do to address it? And we needed a plan of action. That process has been kind of disbanded, unfortunately, but us advocates on the outside are moving to bring it back again.
So I was just told by the principal that we only have 5 minutes.
Should we hear all the questions?
Huh? Pardon?
Should we hear all the questions?
Yes, we'll get these real fast, these two folks here very quickly, and then some quick wrapping up on the stage, okay? Or I will be sent to detention.
Bringing humanity back into the classroom, into the schools, helping to heal the issues of racism that's in the schools. To me, one of the key answers is to return the music, the dancing, the art, the photography, the storytelling, all of those things which opens people's hearts, which opens the children's hearts, which opens the teachers' hearts and the administration, just to be in a school that is filled with art raises the vibration so much. So whatever it is any of you three can think of to say that could just start to get that happening in Baltimore City, 45 minutes of art a week. That's nothing. That is so nothing. The healing comes through the art. It's a sort of an indescribable kind of thing. So just whatever you know that we don't know to get the arts back into the schools, which I think is a part of the solution.
Thank you, Maria Broom.
I'll be very short. I'm the Judge Davis that Taylor earlier referred to, and I had no intention of coming up here, but I couldn't resist. 43 years ago, the Supreme Court of the United States decided a profoundly important case that all of you in here, in one way or another, are affected by. And that's a case called San Antonio Unified School District versus Rodriguez in 1973. And it may well be an instance of too much, too soon, with too little. The claim in that case was that public school education was a fundamental right protected by the Constitution. And what's remarkable about it, and I'll be very brief, no legal lesson here, but what's one of the things most remarkable about it, a couple of things, the plaintiffs from Texas actually won the case at the trial court level. They won. They had federal judges saying, yes, public school education is a fundamental right. And when the case got up to the Supreme Court of the United States, 5-4, the court said, no, it's not. So my point in getting up and sharing a few minutes with you is just to say, we're at a point when we've had a 43-year experiment, and the experimental results are in. And clearly, the right to a public school, a fair and equal public school education, is a fundamental right. And we're at a point in our history when, in fact, future Supreme Courts might very well reverse that decision. Only the Supreme Court of the United States can reverse that decision. And it's my hope, and I was going to ask the panel, but we don't have enough time to hear from them, so you have to be stuck with what I have to say. It is my hope, my fervent hope, whether I live long enough to see it or not, it is my hope that the wisdom of the four justices back in 1973 will one day become the wisdom of five or six or seven justices on the Supreme Court of the United States. I'll stop there.
Amen. Thank you. So let's wrap it up, and we'll start with Taylor. Go to Karen. Eddie, end with Eddie.
I'm just going to take credit for provoking Andre to say that, I'm glad he did. And really, we've talked about big issues. I have learned a lot. I do think when you're talking about disciplining to poverty in the schools, as sobering as it may seem, our prison system is disciplining adults to poverty. So this is part of a great, big, huge problem in the whole society. And in a way, that's depressing, but it makes the instances, like the lady who was talking about what her school was like, all that much more inspirational about what a truly good school experience can do for every kid that's there.
Thank you, Taylor Branch. Karen Weber.
Pointing to my colleague. I don't know how to connect this all together, but the thing that keeps running through my head, and if I don't say it, I may burst, is that we can't forget that in addition to the problems we had 50 years ago when schools were desegregated, we now have had a war on black communities in the form of mass incarceration. And if you go into schools now, you'll see the evidence of it everywhere. And it's like nothing you've ever seen in your life. So when I talk about school climate, for example, and what the students are due, I speak of it not just as a practice, but as a moral imperative. Sometimes that's all they have is your school. So there's a duty, there's a moral obligation to make it the best school that it possibly can be.
Thank you. Eddie Fergus.
I'm glad you said that, because that means I don't have to touch on school climate, the importance of it. And actually, I'm going to follow the thread that Mr. Davis set forth in terms of sort of, so in what way do we use the legal environment as another tool, right? And it for the last 3-4 years, I've been operating as an expert consultant for the Department of Justice when they sue school districts and state education departments for disproportionality. And it took me a while to get to a space where I would feel comfortable to operate in that expert role until I started hearing the language of, we don't want to teach them. They are hard to work with. And so this assault that you're describing, I realize that we also need to be able to utilize, when it's necessary, a legal set of tools to force the types of change that are necessary. I mean, as a history person, you know, I appreciate and recognize the importance of all the legal cases that led up to Brown versus Board, as well as the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. Right, but I'm also recognizing that there may be a need for more of that underground work to continue, mm-hmm. and utilizing the legal system as a tool until we get to that space where we recognize the significance of having a human response to this to this layers of disparity.
Thank you all. Thank you all. Lisa, you want to? I really want to thank our panelists, Karen Weber, Director of OSI Baltimore's Education and Youth Development Program, Pulitzer Prize-winning author and historian Taylor Branch, who are parting the waters that King trilogy that took the nation by storm, and Dr. Edward Fergus, Associate Professor in the New York University's School of Education. And I want to thank ACTS, the Alliance for Community Teachers and Schools, for hosting the event and inviting me to moderate it. For more information, go to acts-alliance.org. And thanks for listening, folks. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our senior producer is Mark Gunnery. Our producer is Imani Spence. Our engineer is Andrew Melton. Our intern is Calvin Perry. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. And to podcast the Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.